have this talk as a PowerPoint lecture on the website. So if you go to the teaching website and look under links, I believe there's a little thing there that says PowerPoint lectures. You'll be able to find this and download it if you want to. So before we get to the technical information, let's talk about what this class is. It's all about art and all of the possibilities inherent in the medium of photography. You know, you may come in here with the concept of what you think photography is. When I took photo one, my understanding of photography in the world was this. I knew about newspaper photography and I knew about National Geographic. Okay? In the world of fine art photography, it wasn't real sort of widespread and out there. Museums really had just started to collect photography and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's a little weird in terms of how photography has been perceived as art. The history of that's not terribly long. So we're going to talk about some of that stuff. So before we do the technical thing, let's look at some pictures. We're going to talk about the kind of things we're going to discuss over the course of the semester. Every time I give an assignment, I will try my best to give you some historical information about photography, the technical part of photography, the conceptual part of photography, so that you have some context to put what you're doing now into that historical context. So what I'm showing you here on the board is the very first known photograph in the history of the medium of photography. It was done by a Frenchman named Joseph Nicéphore Niépce, and it wasn't done on film. It was actually done on a polished pewter plate. The light-sensitive emulsion was some stuff called asphaltum. So, you know, streets are made of asphalt. This is a derivative of the stuff that streets are made of. It was a tar-like substance that was painted on the pewter plate. That substance gets hard when it's exposed to light. And so he coated a plate, put it in a camera, and exposed it. Now, it was really slow. It took a long time. It took over 8 hours to expose this plate. It's a little hard to see what you're looking at, but imagine that you're in a horseshoe-shaped opening, and you're looking out into a courtyard, and you're on the second floor of a chateau in France. So you're in the middle of the courtyard looking down. This is the left side of the building, and this is the roof of the right side of the building, and you're looking out. And what you're seeing is the courtyard, and you can sort of see how the shadows play across that. So it's an 8 hour long exposure. After he got it out of the camera, he developed it with oil of lavender. How strange is that? I bet it smelled really good too. The interesting thing is, a person in Texas bought this a long time ago. So this photograph is actually down at the University of Texas in the Harry Ransom collection. It's the Gernsham collection inside the Harry Ransom Center for Humanities. You can drive down to Austin and you can see the world's first photograph down there. It's pretty cool. You ought to do it sometime. Okay? Yeah.
How big is it?
It's about 6 by 9. It's not real big, you know. It's a strange thing too. It's like looking at a mirror. It's really hard to see, so when you go there, it's displayed in a special little thing. You have to sort of get down and move around to be able to see the whole thing. So we'll talk about things in a historical context from the beginning of the history of photography. So starting about 1826 on up. One of the things we'll talk about in reference to what we do here are technical innovations. I mean, clearly we're on the brink of more new technical innovations with digital photography. Well, the whole history of photography is sort of rife with technical innovations that change things. You know, part of it was shooting on pewter plates. Nobody had ever done that before, even though we had known about the concept of photography since the times of the ancient Greeks. The story is that Aristotle, sitting in a cave, contemplating the fate of mankind, sat in this dark room long enough, and when he opened his eyes, he could see an image that was on the other side of the cave through a pinhole crack in the wall. The concept of pinhole photography has been with us since ancient Greek times. It was only until the 1800s that we got the chemistry to make those images permanent. As soon as that happened, other things happened. People said, well, you know, why do I have to take a picture from the ground? Maybe I can go up in a hot air balloon and take pictures. Nobody had thought of that before. So you have a picture of the Eiffel Tower from a hot air balloon. Aerial photography, right? Technical innovation. So we'll talk about those kinds of things. Early in the history of photography, the medium of photography, was really thought of as a scientific tool because it was so good at rendering detail, unlike any other medium. You know, painters couldn't paint with that sort of detail. So people immediately wanted photography to be this scientific tool. But there were people who took that, who looked at photography and said, you know, it is really good at doing that detail thing, but it also is really good at doing this other thing. I mean, these pictures are interesting to look at for the sake of looking at them. They're art just like painting. That was actually a controversial concept. When photography was invented, there was a big deal in France and Paris at the time where the world of art was centered, and there was a big thing in the newspaper that said painting is dead, right? So there was a point where photography was such an important thing that painters thought they'd never have to paint again. So we'll talk about the concept of photography as art and making art for the sake of making art, right? So we'll talk about those kinds of things. We'll talk about it in terms of culture and how it plays out. This is a picture by one of the most famous photographers in the history of the medium, a guy named Ansel Adams. You've probably all heard that name. You've probably seen his pictures if you hadn't heard his name. Ansel is known for having done these beautiful Western landscapes. They're mostly done in the western half of the United States. This one's one of his most famous ones. It's called Moonrise, Hernandez, New Mexico, 1941. I can tell you, when I was in Photo One, I went to a gallery and saw this picture in person. It was stunning. I mean, it was 30 by 40. It was just the most beautiful photograph. So, Ansel was known for making these really beautiful photographs, but he was also known as an environmentalist. He worked with the Sierra Club for his entire adult life. In fact, he testified before Congress on behalf of the Sierra Club in terms of preserving the wilderness. So he played an important political role. There will be some other people that we'll come across in the history of photography that we'll talk about in terms of politics. I'll show you one here in just a minute. But he also had something to do with people thinking of the people in terms of culture, thinking of photography as a fine art, changing it from just this sort of hobby medium into a very serious art form. So he was one of those guys that really helped elevate photography as art. We'll also talk about not only fine art photography, but photojournalism and documentary photography, how that plays into it. You know, a lot of times when we think of photojournalism, all we think about is what happens in a newspaper, pictures of car wrecks, plane wrecks, and buildings burning and stuff like that. Well, that's part of it. And a lot of times that stuff isn't very artistic, but it's really functional. The person who was probably the spearhead of making photojournalism both artistic and important was a Frenchman named Henri Cartier-Bresson. Was from France. He shot in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. He actually started one of the big photo agencies called Magnum, which is out there. They help get out images to news organizations. Cartier-Bresson coined the phrase the decisive moment. It's that one moment when you're taking a picture that the picture becomes perfect. If you shoot on either side of that moment, you've missed it. The picture may still be okay, but it's not the perfect picture. He has lots and lots of examples of the decisive moment. I'll show you some of them through the course of the semester, and we'll talk about journalism in reference to fine art photography as well. There are other people, also journalists, this guy W. Eugene Smith. Eugene Smith is really the godfather of the photo essay. He's the guy who really invented the photo essay. So there were magazines like Life magazine and Look magazine, National Geographic. W. Eugene Smith worked for Life magazine. He took the idea of not having just one photograph tell the story, but a whole series of photographs that would tell the story. And it was a little different deal. And in order to do that, you essentially had to go live that story. So he would often go live with his subjects for a long time, a month or 2 months or whatever, photograph them extensively, and then compile those photographs into a big, long photo essay. This is from one of his famous ones in Life magazine about Minamata, Japan. It was a little seaside village that had an extraordinarily high rate of birth defects. They found out that this little cove that they fished in was actually contaminated with mercury, and they hadn't known that previously. So he went and did a story about this town. It's a very moving story. And before he did this, there was not really photo essays out there. So he was a real big, important figure in terms of that kind of thing. Now, there's a similar field in photography called documentary photography that has the look of photojournalism, but the audience isn't necessarily intended to be a newspaper or a magazine. It's just for the sake of documenting. There's a guy like this, Bruce Davidson, who's a documentary photographer. He used the same basic approach as W. Eugene Smith. He would go live in that community. He felt like it was really unfair to just sort of go in the community and just start taking pictures of people without sort of being a part of that community. Felt like those pictures didn't tell the whole story. So he felt like it was important to go be part of that community. It also opened up his access to that community too. So, you know, people get a little untrusting. I bet even you guys in class, when somebody walks up to you and like sticks a camera in your face, it's like, hold on, what are you doing? Give me a break here, right? It's a natural sort of reaction. But if you go live with somebody and you start to tell them what you're doing and you're working on this project, they start to open up. That was his approach. So we'll talk about documentary photography in the course of the semester. There's a guy that lives in Texas. He lives in Beaumont. He's the major professor for photography at Lamar University of Beaumont. He's probably one of the world's most famous photographers right now. His name's Keith Carter. His work has a real sort of documentary look to it, in that it's a document of real life. There's no sort of manipulations here. When you look at this, this is a picture of a little kid that had a big plastic bubble over his head. So this isn't a Photoshop manipulation. But there's something different about the way his pictures look. They're more poetic. In fact, when people talk about his work, they often refer to him as the poet of the ordinary. He shoots ordinary, mundane things, but he has a way of looking at them that elevates them and makes them more interesting to look at. So we'll talk about that approach, and I'll show you some more Keith Carter pictures. We'll talk about controversial things. This is one of the most controversial pictures from the 1990s, done by a guy named Andres Serrano. The title of the picture is Piss Christ. It's literally a photograph of a crucifix that was in a jar of urine. Okay, he had a big whole sort of conceptual thing about it that made sense when you read the statement. But the thing that really was important about this particular work was that Andres Serrano applied for and received a grant from the United States government, more specifically from the National Endowment for the Arts. You've probably all heard of the National Endowment for the Arts. It's a good organization. They give money to organizations to help put on operas and things like that. It's a good thing. They used to give out money to individual artists. So he applied for a grant, received $25,000 so that he could pursue his art for a year without having to work. Well, Andres Serrano and several other artists who were equally controversial in terms of their subject matter received these grants. And finally, a U.S. Senator in North Carolina, Jesse Helms, said, you know what? I don't think the United States government ought to fund stuff that I think is offensive. And so started a long controversial decline in the National Endowment for the Arts. You know, it's a little weird. I'm an artist and I believe in individual artist grants, but I can understand how people would not want to fund this. It makes sense. If people say, I'm a religious person, I find this offensive, I can understand that. So we'll talk about some controversial things in a political sort of sense. We'll talk about culture, really. I mean, in the course of this class, you'll be taking pictures. You know, you're not making pictures in a vacuum. Even though you have a relatively small, isolated audience here, you're not making pictures in a vacuum. You're working during a time that has this American culture, whatever that is, right? So we'll talk about cultural context. There's a photographer named Patrick Nagatani. He's a Japanese American. His parents were Japanese. He was born here in America. And, you know, he was born at a time post-World War II where it was okay to be Japanese and living in America, but there's these stereotypes. I mean, if you haven't heard of the stereotype of the Japanese tourist with the camera, you haven't been around, right? He had to grow up with that. So a lot of his work deals with those stereotypes about who he is and, you know, what his culture was like. So frequently in his pictures, you'll see a Japanese person with a camera, right? The other thing involved with the sort of Japanese-American thing is the concept of World War II and what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the atomic bomb. So frequently you'll see some things in his pictures that refer back to the atom bomb. They're all part of his culture. So he was just trying to make work that reflected who he is and the questions he had about life being a Japanese-American. Okay, there'll be other people we'll talk about, and you know, if you look at this work, you wouldn't think it would be all that controversial, but these two guys made controversial artwork. I'll tell you what the controversy was. In the history of photography, especially in regards to the struggle of getting photography to be accepted as art by museums and galleries, there was always that concern that photographs wouldn't last as long as paintings. So, you know, in the museums, we have paintings that are 500, 600 years old, right? So people started thinking, you know, if we're gonna buy photographs, they need to last at least that long. So there's a good deal of the portion of the history of photography where people were very concerned about how they processed their prints. In fact, when I learned how to process prints, black and white prints, there was this really elaborate sort of process where you put your prints through all the chemistry, and then you washed them for a certain amount of time, and then you put them in another set of chemistry that neutralized the other chemistry, and then you washed them again for another set of time, and then you air dried them and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was really elaborate. All of that was done to make sure that they would last as long as they possibly could. Well, the Starnes twins come along and they said, well, all of that's good, but it gets in the way of the kinds of pictures we want to make. So they started making pictures that weren't processed properly. They didn't stay in the developer long enough. They got bleached out. And then the worst sort of thing of all is, rather than mounting them in an archival way, they used Scotch tape and they taped them together. That was the big sin. Everybody, you can't do that. And they said, well, sure I can. You know, it's an interesting picture. It's more interesting this way than it would have been the other way. And they said, well, what am I going to do if it starts to fall apart after I buy it? And they said, well, you'll figure it out, fix it. It was an interesting approach to art making and collection. So, you know, we'll talk about things like that, manipulated photographs, how they go together. What's the best way to do it? Should we be concerned with how long they last? Maybe photography is supposed to be an impermanent sort of thing. So we'll talk about issues like that. Talk about other sort of manipulated photographs. Certainly with the digital age, manipulating photographs has become even easier than it used to be. I have to tell you, I've never been a big believer in the truth of photography because I knew right away it was easy to manipulate the truth. Okay? So these... This picture, Robert Park Harrison's actually two people, a husband and a wife, who have assumed one name for the purposes of art making. They work as a team. They do these highly staged scenes. They photograph them. They seam them together on one piece of paper, and then they paint on top of them. So we'll talk about sort of technical innovations in terms of how we deal with prints. We'll talk about that in the context of historical information. This is a picture done by a guy named Jerry Uelsman. This looks like it was done on a computer, right? It was done in a dark room. I was really fortunate. I had Jerry as a teacher when I was in graduate school. Jerry's probably the most famous photographer known for doing these highly manipulated kinds of prints. He, in his dark room, he had 8 enlargers, and he would put a different negative in each enlarger and really carefully blend them all together on one piece of paper, right? So we'll talk about that and how it relates to what we can do in Photoshop these days. Pretty interesting stuff. So we're going to cover a lot of ground during the course of this semester. Should be pretty interesting. Okay, any questions about any of that? One of the things I want you to remember is as I'm showing pictures like this, you should be paying attention and writing some names down. If you find somebody that's really interesting, you ought to write their name down because you will be doing a talk on a photographer and you may find their name here. It'll be easier to find that information later on. Okay, so let's start with the technical information. So we're going to talk about cameras and the four variables that determine what proper exposure is. Okay, so let's talk about the kinds of cameras that are out there in the world right now. So up until recently, there were only four, but now that we've got digital cameras, there's five basic types of cameras. Okay, you were probably all familiar with 35 millimeter film cameras that had one lens on them, right? It was called a single lens reflex camera. It had one lens that was both the picture taking lens and the viewing lens. And the way that worked is there's a little mirror that hung at a 45 degree angle inside the camera, and when you were looking through the camera, that mirror was down and it bounced the light through the lens up into the little viewfinder, and then when you took the picture, the little mirror flipped up out of the way and let the light go directly back to the film. And it made that noise too. It made that clunky noise that we all associate with taking a picture, right? There were also 35 millimeter cameras that were called rangefinders. It actually had a separate viewing system from the picture taking system, and they were coupled mechanically. So the viewing system, when you looked through it, wasn't the same lens that took the picture. Okay. Now the really good thing about that was it didn't require a mirror hanging at a 45 degree angle inside the camera body. So when you took a picture, there wasn't that clunky sound of that mirror moving up. A lot of photojournalists like to use it because it was really quiet. So if they were covering, say, a press conference, they weren't interrupting people with that noise. Okay. The next one over here you'll see is a twin lens camera. Okay. Twin lens. It had a separate viewing and picture taking lens as well. They were generally stacked one on top of another. So, you know, when I was first learning about photography, all of the high schools had these kinds of cameras, right? That was the camera everybody had because they were nice and cheap and they were easy to use. Then the oldest form of camera that's still in use today, in fact, I use one of these, is called a view camera. Okay, it's one of those old-timey cameras. You have it on a tripod, it's got bellows on it, and you put the dark cloth over your head. You know, they use it from the beginning of the history of photography. People still use them today. Commercial photographers still use them today. So all those nice big ads you see in magazines and stuff that have products in them, chances are they were photographed with a view camera. Okay, so it's still out there, still usable. And then we have the digital cameras. Right, and they're just continuing to evolve all the time and getting better all the time. One of the reasons why we like to put this up here is just to remind you that it's really important that you understand the camera that you have. It's important that you understand how it works, how it functions, where to find all the little parts to it. So again, I'm going to remind you, if you don't have your manual, make sure that when you're sitting down, sit here and download it to this computer so that if you have any questions at all, you and I can sort of, you know, go through that manual and we can figure out how your camera works, because it's going to be really important to understand those functions. Okay, so let's talk about the four variables. What all is involved in getting a properly exposed picture? Well, you have an aperture in your camera. Inside the lens, there's a series of overlapping metal leaves. It's like the iris on your eyeball. It can open and close to control the volume of light entering the camera. So the aperture is one of the variables, okay? The shutter speed, how long the shutter is open, letting the duration of light enter the camera, that's another one of the variables. The ISO setting, or the sensitivity to light, is one of the variables, and it's one of the more complicated ones to figure out with the point and shoot camera, but we'll try and get that all squared away for you. And then the quantity of light in any given situation is also a variable. So right now we're in this room, it's nice and dark. Just because it's dark doesn't mean we couldn't take a picture, right? But if we were to go outside on a bright, sunshiny day, it would be nice and bright. We could take pictures under those lighting conditions too. So the quantity of light is a variable. Okay? So, and this is going to be true whether you're using a film camera or a digital camera. All of these things come into play. Now, the difficult part may be if you have a point-and-shoot camera is knowing which one of those you have total control over. Hopefully, you have control over all of these variables, but some of your cameras may limit you to some degree. We'll try and figure out what the limitations are and figure out how to deal with them, okay? So let's start with the first of those variables. Let's start with the first of those and try and figure out how it works into the process. So the first thing we're going to do is talk about apertures. Apertures are also known as f-stops. Okay, I'm going to use those two phrases interchangeably. They're the same thing. Apertures and f-stops are the same thing. Okay, they refer to the overlapping metal leaves that are inside your camera lens that can open and close to control the volume of light entering the camera. Okay, in fact, on the test, I'm going to have a little fill in the blank part at midterm. It'll say the blank controls the volume of light entering the camera. It's the aperture or f-stop. Okay, now, when we talk about those, and you know, I've got a picture here of an old film camera, because when we talked about apertures on old film cameras, the apertures were there, right? They were printed on the barrel of the lens. They were real easy to find. If you have a single lens SLR digital camera or film camera, you'll be able to see those numbers readily. Now, on the newer cameras, it may not be on the lens barrel anymore, but it may be inside your little viewfinder, but you'll be able to see them. If you have a point-and-shoot camera, you may not actually see these numbers. Okay, this is sort of the weird, tricky part. It doesn't mean that apertures aren't there. They're there. It's just they're trying not to confront you with this number that's so confusing. It's actually not confusing at all. They just don't give you enough credit for being able to figure it out. Here's the deal. There's a standard series of aperture numbers. Okay, those numbers are these. And whenever we talk about them, we use the letter F in front of it, so we know we're talking about apertures as opposed to shutter speeds. The numbers are F2, F2.8, F4, F5.6, F8, F11, F16, and F22. Those are the numbers you need to memorize for the test. Okay? Those are the numbers you need to memorize for the test. Hopefully you'll have a camera where you can actually see those numbers as well, okay? Now, there's a tricky little thing here. So if you have a newer camera, and I say newer, I'd say in the last 5 years or so, that's a single lens reflex camera, more than likely you're gonna see some additional numbers that fall in between these. Those numbers are all okay too, but they're half stops and third stops as opposed to whole stops. So I want you to memorize these numbers because they represent historically whole f-stops for us, okay? If you have a point and shoot camera, there's a place where you can access those numbers. It may be once we're in a file in Photoshop that we can find them, but there are those numbers that are at work in your point-and-shoot cameras. Now, the thing is, we'll get it all figured out. If they're not just like immediately apparent in your camera, don't freak out. It's okay. But you do need to know these for the test, okay? So these represent that opening in the lens set by an overlapping series of metal leaves. Now, what does that number actually mean? This is one of those things that I think that people have always worried that it's really confusing, and it is a little bit, but I'll try to make it clear for you. The f-stop number that you see here, f2.8, is an expression of a ratio, actually. It's not a measurement of how far across that is or how long it is. It's a ratio. The ratio is how wide is this as compared to the distance from the lens to the back of the camera. So when we talk about f-stop numbers, we're talking about a ratio, the diameter of the opening divided by the length of that opening to the back of the camera. Okay, do you need to know that for the test? No. I've actually never known a single person who knew that information made a better picture because they knew it. I mean, it's sort of an interesting scientific thing. And if you take a second photo class, Luther may ask you that on the test. But will it help you make a better picture? No, it won't. Okay, but it does tell you that's how these numbers got their name. It tells you where that number comes from. Okay, so let's talk about apertures. So I gave you the standard series of aperture numbers, 2, 2.8, 4, 5.6, 8, 11, 16, and 22. That's represented by the opening in these lenses. The small number is actually the widest opening. It lets in the most light. Small number, 2.8 lets in the most light. 2 lets in the most light. Okay? 22 down on the other end lets in the least amount of light. In fact, as it turns out, that each of these numbers lets in either twice as much or half as much light as the one before it or after it. Okay, this is a really important phrase. It'll be on the test. When I say, what's the mathematical relationship that exists between these aperture numbers? Is that each one of these lets in either twice as much light or half as much light as the one before it or after it. What does that mean? So, if I start here in the middle and I change the aperture number to a wider one, I'm letting in twice as much light as I did here. Okay. If I start in the middle and change it to one that's one more closed, I'm letting in half as much light as I did previously. It's hard to tell from looking at it because it's a circle. People have a hard time understanding the area of a circle. If that aperture was actually a square, you would literally see the squares twice as big or half as big. Okay, so it's a little difficult. But each one of these lets in half as much or twice as much as the one before it or after it. This is going to be a really important concept that will play out through all of the technical parts of photography. The same thing will apply to shutter speeds, and the same things will apply to ISOs as well. Okay? Now, that aperture controls the volume of light. So let me make a quick little analogy. So when we're talking about photography, we're talking about letting in the proper amount of light. Not only the volume of light, but the duration of light. It's sort of like a water faucet. So you can put a 1 gallon bucket under a water faucet and you can turn it on so it's just a drip, but it will eventually fill up the bucket if you leave it on long enough, right? Or you can turn the faucet on a lot and it'll fill up really quickly, but you've gotten to the same result. The bucket's full, right? The same thing's true in photography. You can let in a lot of light with the aperture, but not let in much with the shutter speed, or you can do it the other way around. Okay, so everybody got that concept? We're trying to get the proper amount of light into the camera. Now, when we do that with the aperture, there's a secondary effect from changing that aperture from one to another. So, you know, the question might be, well, does it matter which aperture I use? The answer is going to be yes, because it will affect the way the picture looks. The aperture will also control the amount of depth of field. So let me define depth of field for you. Depth of field is the amount of the picture from the foreground to the background that appears to be in focus. Okay, depth of field is the amount of the picture from the foreground to the background that appears to be in focus. This is going to be one of those first creative choices you have to make. How much of your picture is going to appear to be in focus? So let's look at this example here. The picture on your left has a small f-stop number, okay, like 2 or 2.8. Small numbers give small depth of field. I think that's the easiest way to think about it. Small number gives small depth of field. That means very little picture from the foreground to the background will appear to be in focus. And when we're looking at this example of this guy sitting on this wall, you can see he is clearly sharp and in focus. Right? The camera's focused on him. He's clearly sharpened and focused. But as you go back in space, you see that the building behind him is soft and blurry. That's not a function of where he focused necessarily. It's a function of what aperture number he's using. And he's using a small aperture number, 2 or 2.8, something like that. Okay? If you look at the picture on the right, where everything in the picture is in focus, that's large depth of field. I would define that as everything in the picture from the foreground to the background appears to be in focus. Okay? They did that not by changing where they were focused, but by changing the aperture number to a large aperture number. So, large aperture number, large depth of field. Okay? That's the simplest way to think about it. If you need to make a picture that has a large amount of depth of field, you want to use a large aperture number to do that. Okay? That's pretty simple. Now, if you have a point-and-shoot camera and you don't see those numbers, what are you supposed to do? Well, you're going to need to look at your camera, you're going to need to look at your manual and figure out on your camera how you do this. There will be a mode, most likely, that has to do with like the flower mode. If you have the little flower mode on your camera, that's generally intended to be close-up pictures, but it also, as a result, gives you very shallow depth of field. If you have like the mountain mode, that mode is supposed to give you a large amount of depth of field so that you can literally shoot from the mountains and have it be in focus. Does that make sense? And you may have a portrait mode where there's a bunch of little people there. That sort of gives you that in-between amount of depth of field. Does that make sense? So while you may not be able to see these numbers, I'm almost positive there's an equivalent function on your camera. You just may have to dig around a little bit to figure out what it is. Okay? So large aperture openings like F2 or small numbers, I would say, give you shallow depth of field. Large numbers give you large depth of field. So you'll want to think about that. It's a creative control. Why is it creative? Well, you know, it allows you to control how much of the picture is in focus, and by doing that, you're telling your viewer, which we are now your audience, you have a built-in audience here, you're telling us what we should be looking at in your picture. Okay? One of the examples I like to use in photojournalism is if the President of the United States had come to town and he was greeting a large number of people and they were all gathered around him, and you took a picture with a large depth of field so that everybody's head and face was in focus, it might be difficult to pick the president out of that group of people, right? But if you do a shallow depth of field picture where just the president and anybody who's in line with him is in focus, then you control who we see is in focus. And we say, oh yeah, the president. I mean, we still know there's people out there in the crowd even though they're out of focus. But they aren't the important ones. Seeing him's important. So that's what you're going to be doing. You're going to be controlling what we're supposed to see. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, there's an interesting thing about depth of field. Depth of field, it's not a static thing. It's a living, breathing thing, depending on how you set your camera. So in this example here on the upper left-hand corner, you see you've got a boy that's in the extreme foreground, his face is out of focus, and then you see a little bit behind him, there's another boy who's nice and sharp, and then even further back in space, there's a guy back there, he's way out of focus. It's almost impossible to tell if it's a human being, right? So this is a shallow depth of field picture, and the only thing that's in focus is the boy who's out there in the middle. Now, if you look at the picture down below, it shows how much of the picture is actually in focus. So you'll see there's a little diagram here. The photographer focused on his face, okay? And then there's a little bit of space in front of his face that's in focus. So like you see, you know, his jacket's out in front of him. His jacket's still in focus, stuff like that. And then you'll see there's an additional amount of space behind his head that is also in focus. If there was anything else in the picture that was in that particular plane of focus, it would also be sharp in the picture. Okay? Now, anything outside of that plane is out of focus. Okay? That's determined by the aperture number. So this was a small aperture number, so a small depth of field. So you see, there's like maybe a plane of focus that's about a foot deep in focus. Does that make sense? Everybody nod your head, yes, that makes sense. Okay, good. Okay, so in the second example, we have the same setup, but you'll see all of the people are in focus. The boy who's close is in focus, and now the man in the background's in focus as well. The photographer didn't change where they were focused at. He still focused on that kid, But by changing the number, the aperture number, to a larger aperture number, in this case, if you had a point-and-shoot camera and you had the mountain mode would be what you would want to use here because it gives you a larger amount of depth of field. And you'll notice where there was once that little section that was in focus, it's now expanded out to here. So by changing that aperture number, you change the amount of space that's going to appear to be in focus. Okay, everybody got that? Now, you'll notice there's a weird little thing about that. It would be nice that if you could take your amount of depth of field, it was just divided right in half. Half of that amount's in front of where you're focused and half is behind, but it doesn't work quite that way due to the laws of physics and optics. That amount of depth of field, however much you have, whether it's 1 foot worth of depth of field or 20 feet worth of depth of field, is not divided equally. It's divided into thirds. So wherever you're focused, roughly one third of the amount of that is in front of your subject and roughly two thirds is behind it. So however much depth of field you have, roughly one third of that amount is in front of where you're focused and two thirds is behind. Now, is this a critical thing? On an everyday photographic basis, it's probably not going to be critical information. But there are certain circumstances where it may come into play that it's really helpful to know this, okay? Like if you're in a really tight space, you may only have so much area that you can focus and deal with in terms of depth of field. So the thing to remember is, if two-thirds of the amount of your depth of field is not being used, you could potentially focus in a slightly different location and still have things be in focus. For diagrammatic purposes, I've got this picture of Queen Elizabeth here, and you notice up here Queen Elizabeth's reviewing the guards, and you'll see that that plane of focus that runs right through her is nice and sharp. Okay, the soldiers, the line of soldiers to her right, your left, you'll see that the guy who's directly to her side is also very, very sharp. But if you look down the line of soldiers and you come forward from where she is, you'll see they slowly get out of focus. And as you go back in space, they slowly get out of focus there as well, right? But anybody who's within that large depth of field there, for instance, the soldier who's immediately behind her and the next guy as well, you'll notice they're also in focus too. So they happen to fall in that rather large plane of depth of field. So it's not something that's going to come into play every time you take pictures. It's one of those, it's a good thing to sort of keep in the back of your head for that special circumstance. Now, one of the things I want to tell you also about the point-and-shoot cameras, as limited as they are, one of the really good things about them is they tend to have very large depth of field because of the way they're designed. I mean, really, they were designed so that you couldn't make any mistakes. They were really designed for doing, like, you know, family photo albums, Christmas pictures, pictures of, you know, Aunt Mary and Uncle Joe. And the manufacturers really didn't want anybody to be out of focus. So they designed your cameras to have a large amount of depth of field. The most difficult part you'll have with those point-and-shoot cameras is getting very shallow depth of field. They aren't designed to give you shallow depth of field. So that's going to be the biggest challenge for those of you with point-and-shoots. Is it a big dramatic thing? No, not necessarily. It's just a little challenge, right? You'll have to figure out how to deal with it. So this is depth of field and how it's divided up. Just to recap about apertures before we move on to shutter speeds, let's sort of go over this. Apertures are also known as f-stops. They refer to a series of overlapping metal leaves that are inside your lens. You can control how open and closed those are by changing the aperture number if you have one of those cameras, or changing the mode on your point and shoot. Okay? It controls the volume of light entering the camera. Okay? So the bigger the opening is, the more the light that goes through. But they also control how much of the picture appears to be in focus, which we call depth of field. Okay, so it does more than one thing. It controls the volume of light and controls how much appears to be in focus. Everybody got that? Are there any questions about apertures? If it's not totally clear to you, don't worry. We're going to be covering the same information for a number of weeks yet to go. In fact, we'll do an assignment that's really specifically about depth of field. So you'll explore the concept of depth of field. Okay, so let's move on to shutter speeds. So it works with apertures, in conjunction with apertures, to control how much light enters the camera. So shutter speeds, there's an interesting thing in terms of the technology of shutters these days. In older cameras and in some high-end digital cameras, there's literally a curtain that's directly in front of the film or digital chip. Okay, it's called a focal plane shutter. It's the one here on your right. It's either metal or cloth. It has a little slit in it, and when you push the shutter button, it moves in front of the film plane or the digital plane. Okay. Now, some point-and-shoot cameras don't have that physical shutter. The way your shutter speed works is the camera literally turns the chip on and off for a certain amount of time. Okay. Is there a positive thing about having a physical shutter versus turning a chip on and off? Not as far as I can tell. It's just a design difference, really. Okay. So we're not going to talk a lot about the physical nature of these shutters, but what you should understand is we're going to be referring to the duration of light hitting your film or digital chip. On older film cameras, it was always real easy to know what shutter speed you were on because there was a little dial up on top of the camera that had all the standard series of shutter speeds listed on the top. You literally, if you wanted to shoot at an eighth of a second, you turned it to it got in front of the eight there, okay? Your point-and-shoot cameras may not have these numbers. Your high-end digital cameras will have these numbers, but they may be inside the screen. You are going to be responsible on the midterm exam for knowing these numbers. So, the standard series of shutter speeds are the ones I've listed here. Now, we always start with the letter B, not a number, clearly. But what B represents is every time longer than 1 second. To give you a little history about what that B stands for, back in the beginning of the history of camera making, there were not mechanical shutters that could give you accurate shutter speeds. So what they did was they literally had a leather bulb that had air in it that was attached to a leather tube that was attached to a shutter. And when you squeezed the bulb, it opened the shutter up. And as long as you were squeezing the bulb, the shutter was open. And when you were ready, you let go of the bulb and the shutter closed. That's where the B comes from in terms of that name. Bulb stands for that. We tend to think of it as anytime you're pushing the shutter button is open. Okay, that's what B stands for. Now, I'm going to go over some stuff on the board that gets into a little more detail about what B stands for in terms of the math of the shutter speeds. But for now, just understand this. B is any time longer than 1 second. The rest of the numbers are these. 1 full second. And then the rest of these numbers are fractions of a second. As we go out, they get faster and faster and faster. Okay? So those times are 1/2 of a second, 1/4 of a second, 1/8 of a second, 1/15 of a second, 1/30 of a second, 1/60 of a second, 1/125 of a second, 1/250 of a second, 1/500 of a second, and 1/1000 of a second. Those are the standard series of shutter speeds. Now, your cameras may have more than those listed, but these are the ones that you will be responsible for on the test. If you know these numbers, you'll be good for the test, okay? I actually have a camera, all my cameras have several shutter speeds faster than 1/1000 of a second, and nearly all of the cameras these days list times longer than 1 second. 2 seconds, 4 seconds, 8 seconds, 15 seconds, 30 seconds, and a minute frequently is what they go up to. So don't be afraid if your camera has more than these. Just remember these specifically for the test. The interesting thing is this system of how we determine exposure is set up so that everything's exactly the same. Like apertures, shutter speeds let in either half as much light or twice as much light as the one before it or after it. So on the test, I'm going to say, describe the mathematical relationship that exists between shutter speeds and apertures. What that really means is each of these numbers lets in either half as much or twice as much as the one before it or after it. Okay? So if we were looking at 1/60 of a second and we changed our shutter speed to 1/30, we've let in twice as much light as we had at a 60th. Or if we turned it from 1/60th to 125th, by doing that, we let in half as much light as we did before. Does that sort of make some sense? Okay. Now, the interesting thing is, like apertures had two functions. They not only controlled the volume of light, but controlled how much of the picture appears to be in focus. Shutter speeds have a secondary function as well. Not only does it control the duration of light entering the camera, it also controls the apparent movement of your subject matter. So, you can get pictures that are blurry, or you can get stop action pictures. That's going to be a creative choice you get to make in the picture making process. Okay? If you're taking a picture and you have subject that's moving, you're going to have to decide, would this picture be more interesting if the subject's blurred, or would it be more interesting if the subject is stopped in mid-motion? Right? So every time you go out and take pictures for the rest of the semester, you're going to be having that thing to think about. You're going to think, how much of the picture is supposed to be in focus, and how much are my subjects supposed to be moving or not? Okay, that's where the creative part of photography comes in. So you'll notice this picture on the left has the blurry picture of the hammer. I mean, the thing about this picture is it really gives us a good idea that the hammer's in motion and it's about to hit that nail. It has a particular feel about it. It gives us a certain amount of information about what's happening in this picture. You know, the other picture where the hammer is stopped mid-motion, you could look at that and say, well, you know, maybe the person's just holding the hammer there. Maybe they're not actually moving the hammer at all. So you're going to have to decide which of these pictures is the most interesting. Which of these pictures conveys the information you want your viewer to understand? So that's why it's going to be important to understand how and why you might want to manipulate shutter speeds. Now, there's a quirky little thing about motion in reference to photography you need to understand. It's a little bit weird, but you'll get the hang of it. When things move in front of the camera, if they move directly in front of the camera from side to side, they're much more likely to show blurred movement than if your subject's moving towards you or away from you. So if you really need to see blurred movement in your picture, you want to make sure that you have the camera set up so that the movement's happening in front of the camera and not coming towards you. Does that make sense? I'm going to describe why that is. Now notice in my photographic examples here, the picture on the left was shot at a 30th of a second. Keep this in mind because I'm going to show you another picture taken at a 30th of a second where she's not blurred, right? Because she's moving side to side in front of the camera, literally what happens when the picture is being taken is as she drives through the frame, a point of light leaves her shoulder, enters the camera. The shutter's still open. She moves a little further. The same point of light hits in a different place on the film. And she moves a little bit further. Same point of light hits in a slightly different place. That's how we see blurred movement. Okay? On the other hand, when the shutter was at a 500th of a second, the shutter was so quick that it just had time for one point of light to hit in one place on the film. So that's why it renders as sharp. That sort of makes sense. So the longer the shutter is, the more opportunity is for light to bounce off of your subject and back into the camera at a slightly different location on the film or digital chip. Okay. Now, if you have your subject moving directly towards you or away from you, you'll notice at the same 30th of a second shutter speed, this person's going directly towards the camera, and yet she's not blurred. Why is that? It's because of the relative place on the film or digital chip the light is hitting. So if you're going directly in front of the camera from side to side, the light's hitting at a different location on that film or digital chip. But if you're going directly towards the camera, all of that light's hitting in basically the same place. It's not really changing that much. So we tend to not see blurred movement quite as much. Does that sort of make sense to you? Okay. Now, there's one other type of shutter speed picture. So we tend to think of there being subject being blurred or subject being stopped, but you'll notice in this case the subject's sharp but the background's blurred. How in the world did that happen? What the photographer did was, rather than having their camera be stationary, they moved their camera when they took the picture. So when they moved their camera, they tried to keep the girl on the bicycle in the same place in the picture. So all the light from her kept hitting the same place on the film, but as she turned it, all the background hit in a slightly different place. That's known as a panning shot. Okay, that can also be an equally interesting blurred picture. So when we talk about shutter speeds in terms of an assignment, we'll have an assignment that's about exploring shutter speeds. You're going to have some options. You'll be able to shoot a stop action photo. You'll be able to do two versions of blurred photos, right? So that's how you do it. So it's just, you know, it's not stuff that you'll be thinking about all the time, but you need to have it sort of in the back of your head as you're shooting so you'll understand what your options are in terms of picture making. Now, the thing is, apertures and shutter speeds don't work independently of one another. They work together to make a picture. They both control how much light's entering the camera, and they both control the physical description of the picture as well. So there'll be a difference in how much picture appears to be in focus and how much apparent motion there is. So these different combinations you'll be able to come up with, can be pretty interesting. So just to show you an example, here I've got three pictures of the same subject matter shot three slightly different ways, but you'll notice they're all exposed identically. In terms of the overall brightness and darkness of the picture, they look identical, yet in terms of the depth of field and the motion, they look vastly different. So this picture on the left, they had a very slow shutter speed. So you can see the birds, the pigeons that are in this picture are moving. And in fact, some of them moved so quickly that we can see through them, and some of them don't even appear at all. They disappeared. They moved so quick we can't even see them. But you'll also notice, and it's a little bit hard to tell in this digital version, in addition to that sort of movement, there's also a large amount of depth of field in this picture too. So it's in focus not only from the beginning, but all the way to the very back of the picture as well. So we had both slow movement and large depth of field to consider. In the middle picture, it's sort of a middle of both of those things. So the birds are moving a little bit. Some of them are sharp, depending on how much they moved, and some of them are blurred, depending on how much they moved. In terms of depth of field, the picture is still sharp from the beginning, but as we start to get back to these people on the benches, they start to go out of focus. So as we picked sort of a middle aperture and a middle shutter speed, we started to get a medium amount of movement and depth of field. And then in the last example, they had a very, very fast shutter speed. So the birds are literally stop action, frozen in midair. Their wings are perfectly sharp. But you'll notice that also affected the amount of depth of field. So there's very little depth of field in this picture. So these birds are nice and sharp, and the bricks are nice and sharp. But once you get beyond the birds, it's really way out of focus, right? So you're going to have those sorts of options when you're taking pictures. And the question we're going to ask when you turn them in, when we have critiques and we discuss pictures, if you were to turn in all three of those, we would look at you and say, which one's the most interesting? Which one's the most interesting? Well, you know, some people may find this one the most interesting because the birds are perfectly sharp and they're in midair. We don't normally see pigeons frozen in midair. They appear to be hovering, right? So there's something interesting and unique about that. It's not something we see with our normal human vision. Other people may like this one over here that's more extreme because the pigeons are moving. They're almost ghost-like. They have this sort of ethereal quality about them, right? So we're all going to have these different things, these different ideas about what we think photography is and what we expect out of photography. And, you know, we'll have these sort of aesthetic decisions that we're going to make about what we like in photography. So it's really important to understand the options you have when you shoot, because you'll be able to manipulate those things at will as you're out shooting. So let's recap shutter speeds really quickly. So shutter speeds come in a standard series of numbers, and we're going to talk about those. The standard series of numbers starts with the letter B. B stands for bulb, or basically anything longer than 1 second. Then the rest of them are 1 second, a half of a second, a quarter of a second, an eighth of a second, a 15th of a second, a 30th of a second, a 60th of a second, 125th of a second, a 250th of a second, 500th of a second, and a 1,000th of a second. Those are the standard series of shutter speeds. There will be some that are longer and shorter than that. They're perfectly legitimate shutter speeds. It's just these are the ones we want to know for the test. Like apertures, shutter speeds also, in addition to controlling the duration of light, also control the apparent motion of your subject matter within the frame. And so that's going to be a creative control as well. Remember, you'll get more blurred movement if your subject's moving side to side in front of the camera, and less blurred if they're moving towards you or away from you in the camera. Okay? So those are the main features of shutter speeds. As we do these assignments, I'm actually going to add a little more stuff to them, but that's what we need to know for today. Now, apertures and shutter speeds work together, and the way they work together is by metering. So you can't really just sort of point your camera out there and expect the picture to be perfectly exposed. There's another thing that happens inside your camera. When you push the button, a meter says this is how much light is required to make the proper exposure. So we're going to talk a little bit about metering and proper exposure. Pardon me. So first, let's talk about what it is we're going to meter, right? What we're going to talk about metering is the visible spectrum, the light that we can see with the human eyes. Okay, that generally extends from the sort of violet part of the spectrum to the red part of the spectrum, the rainbow, essentially. Okay, there are specialty films and digital cameras that record other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. There's X-ray film, for instance, that's part of that spectrum. There's special film for that. There's now special digital cameras that also read X-rays. There's also film that reads infrared light. It doesn't see visible light. It only sees the infrared reflecting off of subjects. So there's some interesting stuff out there in terms of that. So what we're concerned with is the part of the spectrum that we can see. The meter inside your camera meters for that. Now, in the old days, when we were talking about film, what we were talking about is having a piece of plastic that had on top of it a coating of gelatin, the same basic gelatin that they use to make Jell-O gelatin, right? Inside that gelatin was suspended a bunch of minutely ground particles of a form of silver that was in there. Silver is sensitive to light. When light would hit the silver, it would change chemically depending on the amount of light that hit it, and when you developed it, it would change again chemically depending on how long it was in the chemicals. Digital chips are a little bit different. It's, you know, silicon diode chips that are sensitive to light, and like film, depending on how much light hits it, depends on how much exposure you actually get. Okay? Film would come in all these different formats. Right now, in terms of the digital world, you don't see a great variety in the number of formats. With film, you had cameras that had pictures that were little tiny ones, all the way up to sheet film that was 8 by 10 inches. The camera that I use uses 4 by 5 inch film. Literally, the film is 4 inches by 5 inches and it comes in a sheet. It gives me a highly detailed picture. I could literally make a blow up of that that's 40 by 50 inches and you could see lots and lots of detail. There's benefits to using big cameras like that. And there was a whole range of sizes in between. There's medium format cameras. If you've ever heard the name of the manufacturer Hasselblad, they were famous for making cameras that would give you a 2.25 inch by 2.25 inch square negative, right? In the digital world, there's pretty much the cameras you guys are using, which is slightly smaller. The digital chip is slightly smaller than a piece of 35 millimeter film. Okay, and there are larger pieces. There is a 4x5 digital back. You could go buy a 4x5 digital back. It costs $30,000 right now, so I don't have one. The school doesn't have one. There's a Hasselblad medium format digital camera. The camera and the back cost $30,000, so you could get a camera with your back if you wanted to spend $30,000. And that's really it. So there's like 35 millimeter and medium format and large format and that sort of bit with digital, and it's terribly expensive at this point, but it keeps coming down in price all the time. If right now you have like a digital rebel in this class, if you don't know this, when they first came out, those cameras cost $1,500 and now they're down in the $600 range. So the price is falling all the time. It's sort of an interesting thing about photography, and people just keep looking for better and better cameras, and they keep getting cheaper and cheaper. Now, the interesting thing is film, it was real easy to tell what ISO your film was or how sensitive your film is to light because there was always a number printed on the box. When you go to the camera store, you'd say, I want some 400 Kodak film. What that was really saying was, I want ISO 400 film. And we knew what that meant in terms of its relative sensitivity to light. Digital cameras have ISO ratings as well, but the point-and-shoot cameras make it really difficult to find that information. So if you have a point-and-shoot camera, one of the things I'm going to tell you that you ought to look into this weekend is open up your manual and figure out how to find the ISO number and figure out how to make it stay at a particular number. The bad problem about a point-and-shoot camera is if you shoot it on totally automatic, your ISO changes given the lighting condition. And that can be a tricky sort of thing. So that's sort of a little assignment for you. If you have a point-and-shoot, look in your manual or look it up online. How do you find the ISO number and how do you change it? Okay? That ISO number refers to its relative sensitivity to light, and we refer to that as either being faster or more sensitive to light or slower and less sensitive to light. Okay? There's ramifications from using a slower ISO or a lower ISO number or a faster ISO number. A lower ISO number will make your shutter speed slower and it'll do all that stuff, but it will give you a finer image quality. So I tend to lean towards using low ISO numbers, and if I have to, I use a tripod because of that. Okay? Faster ISO numbers can be really good. It'll give you faster shutter speeds when you change that, but it also changes the image quality as well. It'll make it grainier looking. In film, we refer to it in grain. In digital, we refer to it as noise. So those are some things we'll have to consider about ISOs. So digital photographers have the same basic system as film photographers did, and ISO is important. It's maybe not the most important part of that equation, but it's going to be an important part to think about. So to get the correct exposure, you're going to have to do these things. You're going to have to set your ISO. On most of your cameras, it'll be set automatically to begin with. Okay, so it's helpful to know what the ISO is. But what you're going to do is you're going to point your camera at your subject matter. Light's going to reflect off of your subject matter, and inside the camera there's a little chip that'll read that quantity of light, and it'll say, okay, based on what you've got your shutter speed or aperture set at, this is the appropriate exposure. Okay, I'm going to go into that in a little more detail after we turn on the lights and look at the board. It's a little bit difficult to think about this, but all of these meters are calibrated to give you middle gray. So I brought a gray card in here. Every meter out there in the world is calibrated for this gray. Why is that? Well, if you go out into the world and point your camera at a general scene, one there where there's an average number of lights and an average number of darks and an average amount of color out there in the world, if you were to take all of that and change it to some numbers and mathematically average them out, they would average out to this. Okay? So that's why a camera set on automatic generally gives you pretty good pictures. But if you've ever shot in sort of an extreme lighting condition, let's say snow for instance, where everything's really bright and you got the pictures back and your snow was all gray, that's because your camera is calibrated for middle gray. When it saw all that white, it didn't know it was supposed to be snow. Your cameras aren't that smart just yet. It just says, okay, this is what it's going to take to make that middle gray. That's why your snow turned out gray. I could point my camera at a black bag. My camera doesn't know it's supposed to be a black bag. It just says, okay, here's what it's going to take to make it middle gray. So it's the extreme parts of the shooting situation that get a little difficult. Generally speaking, these meters work really good under average situations. So what we're going to be dealing with in terms of class is understanding how those extreme situations work and how to deal with them. When you meter, there's some strategies for making sure you get accurate exposure. I'm going to describe just a couple of situations. You see this picture here. I mean, this is the first example up on the top. There's a guy who's standing there, and there's a fairly bright wall behind him. And if you were metering from this vantage point, you see what happens is the guy's skin turns out too dark. That's because the meter was also reading all of this bright stuff. Because the meter's trying to make it middle gray, it makes it too dark, and it makes his skin, which is already middle gray, go darker. Does that sort of make sense? How do you deal with that? How do you fix that? Well, the simplest way to do it is to simply change your physical position in terms of metering. So the one mistake I think a lot of people in photo one make in terms of metering is they decide this is where they're going to take the picture from, and then they never move from that, even for metering. The really simple solution is simply walk up to the guy's face, meter this far away from their face, find out what the correct reading is, set that into the camera, then back up to take that picture. That make sense? Now, the tricky part is some cameras, if you push the little button, it'll let you meter it, but if you lift your finger off the button, then the meter reading goes away. On your cameras, there's probably going to be a function called auto exposure lock. AE lock. You'll want to look up in your manual how to access that little setting. So it will allow you to walk up to somebody, meter, lock in the proper exposure, and then back up and take the correctly exposed picture. Okay? So that's something you want to look at over the weekend. So what do you do in a strange situation where you're doing like a cityscape? So, you know, this person clearly is on top of another building and they're, you know, trying to get a cityscape picture. How do you apply that concept in terms of metering? Well, you know, the photographer's not gonna like go down 50 stairs, get in a cab, drive to the middle of downtown, meter off of a building, go back in the cab, go up in the building, and then take their picture. They're not gonna do that. The main thing you need to remember is you just need to not meter anything that's overly bright. So here's, I'm going to give you a general rule of thumb. It won't work always because there are certain conditions where you might want this. But generally speaking, I'm going to say do not meter off of the sky. Never meter off of the sky. The sky is always brighter than it needs to be in terms of metering. Okay, so don't meter the sky. What you would do is you, on top of the building, you just tilt your camera down. Meter off of all of this city stuff because it's going to average out to middle gray. Lock that exposure into your camera, tilt the camera back up to get the composition you want, then take the picture. Okay, it's a simple, simple thing, and a lot of students get a little bit lazy with it. I'm telling you, that extra little step of just tilting your camera down and getting the proper reading will save you lots and lots of trouble. Okay? So those are just a couple of strategies for proper metering that will work with just about any camera that you work with. Okay? So I'm going to leave you with this in terms of this slide talk. It's critical to understand how your camera works. It's a really, really important thing for you to understand, particularly since there's been thousands of cameras made since I've started teaching. It's next to impossible for me to keep up with every camera manufactured. So you need to understand how your camera is supposed to work and also have the manual downloaded to your computer so that if we can't figure it out, I can sit down with the manual and help you. So it's going to be important to understand how your camera works to successfully do these assignments we're going to do. All digital imaging is based on what came before in terms of the history of photography, so it's important to understand the controls you have available for creative purposes. So the same concept of shutter speeds and apertures has been working in the history of photography. The same concerns photographers had in 1826 are the same concerns we have in 2008. We need to know how to control the shutter speed. We need to know how to control the aperture to get the proper amount of exposure. If we don't do that, we don't get well-exposed pictures, and it's hard to make a good print from that. If you have a point-and-shoot digital camera, you really need to familiarize yourself with the following modes if you have them: shutter priority, aperture priority, and manual, which we probably won't use on those cameras, and programmed exposure. If you have those modes, you need to learn how to use them. They're really, really useful modes. Okay. If you have other kinds of cameras that allow you to do manual, if you have like a single lens reflex digital camera, you'll have a manual mode that makes it a little easier to manipulate shutter speeds and aperture, so you can do that too. So what I'm saying is you really need to be familiar with the camera you're using, and if you get familiar with it, you'll have much more of that sort of creative control available to you. Okay, so that's it for this part of the talk. So why don't we take a little break? Okay, I'm gonna flip on the lights, watch your eyes. Oh, there it is. Okay, so let's take like a 10-minute break. I've got 3:20 on my watch, so come back about 3:30. We'll sit down, we'll talk a little bit more. We'll flesh out the shutter speed and aperture thing a little bit more. I'm going to show you a little metering thing, and then I'll cut you loose for the weekend.